Okay, we're in session 6 of 1 Samuel. We're going to deal with chapter 17 and following, David and Saul. Again, to get you focused, we're of course focusing on the monarchy, the opening of it, Saul the first king, and David's been anointed, but he's not in place yet. We're, as you realize, I think that 1 Samuel deals with the up through end of Saul. It closes with the death of Saul. 2 Samuel will deal with the career of David. And then 1 and 2 Kings will carry it from Solomon on, and the civil war and the dividing of the kingdom. We will get to Chronicles, which will parallel 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, those three books, from the point of view of the southern kingdom itself. First book of Samuel. We've talked already about how Samuel rose to his office. We've seen Saul appointed, but with a very promising beginning, but we're going to see his folly and sin, especially in the coming chapters. And then, of course, David, who's been anointed, he'll have some service before Saul, and then he'll finish the book out with his years as a fugitive. And so that's a quick profile. In 1 Samuel 17, we have a story that I'm sure all of us have experienced. And let's just go through. It's interesting that this familiar story carries many lessons. We won't take the time to try to exploit that, but let's be sensitive to the fact that there's lots of application for you and I, because you and I face giants in our lives too. And hopefully we can face it with the same kind of power that David was able to draw upon. Now the Philistines had gathered together their armies to battle and were gathered together at Shochoh, which belongeth to Judah, and pitched between Shochoh and Azekah in Ephesdamim. And that's the coast of Damim, but anyway, it'll be to the west of Bethlehem and all of that. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched in the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines. Now, if you take a look at Israel and you zero in on the Dead Sea and westward, you're going to have the region that most of our activities are going to deal with. If you go just west of Bethlehem, you find the Valley of Elah, just a little bit south of Jerusalem, southwest of Jerusalem, and that's where this whole episode is going to, this drama is going to take place. The Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other. There was a valley between them. And there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. And if you assume that's an 18-inch cubit, you're talking a guy that's about 9 feet 9. Some scholars believe that there was a 21-inch cubit, and if so, he's over 10 feet tall. And so it's a... he's pretty terrifying. The two armies apparently intimidate each other anyway, so this whole idea of having a champion go out and settle the day was the proposal. And, so obviously the Philistines surface this giant, and, we're gonna talk a little bit more about him. He's their great champion. And can you imagine how terrifying that would be? Here's a professional, a guy's been a trained warrior all his life, who's literally about 10 feet tall, who's gonna take him on. And now, if Saul had really been walking in the Spirit, he would have claimed Deuteronomy 20 or whatever and taken him on. But he's when people are out of fellowship with God, they can only lead into defeat. And that was Saul's pattern. He had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. That's about 125 pounds. You can figure about 40 shekels per pound. And so, but when they say brass, it's really what you and I would call bronze. But nevertheless, an armor of this kind, by the way, is found in the sculpture, the Assyrian sculptures. Apart from the javelin, all of his defensive armor was bronze, and those that were for attack were of iron. And the iron, as I mentioned before, those of us who remember our study from Judges, was a unique proprietary technology of the Philistines, at least in that region. And he had greaves of brass or bronze upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. A target or gorget. It's a piece of armor protecting the throat, sort of an ornamental collar typically, covering the throat and sometimes part of the shoulders. And the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of Ireland, or about 15 pounds, just the tip. Can you imagine? And one bearing a shield went before him. So this is what they're facing. Can you imagine volunteering to face this guy on behalf of your constituency? Terrifying stuff. And he stood and he cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, Why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Am I not a Philistine, and ye servants to Saul? Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. If he be able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. So that's the proposal. Incidentally, the Targum of Jonathan, incidental thing, states that Goliath went on to boast that it was he who killed Hophni and Phinehas, and he's the one that carried the ark to the house of Dagon, and on many occasions had slaughtered Israelites. So he apparently is a man of some repute in the region, as one can imagine. This idea of a battle being determined by champions, a contest between two warriors, is also, that in the Trojan War, we had Achilles and Hector and so forth. It's an ancient tradition in some respects. So Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine. They were dismayed and greatly afraid. That's sort of understandable in the flesh, isn't it? Can you imagine? It's glib for us who've read the story and know how it ends to say, gee, what are they afraid of? But let's face it, that's tough stuff. And now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. And he had 8 sons, and the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. So Jesse's getting on in years. We can infer that from a number of cases here anyway. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to the battle. And the names of these 3 sons that went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him, Abinadab, and third, Shammah. Now David was the youngest, and the 3 eldest followed Saul. So David was around from time to time, but he really operated out of his home, which was in Bethlehem. David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. He didn't remain permanently. Remember, he went back and forth when he served Saul in the earlier chapters. So he'd visit the court when he could, but at the same time, he didn't neglect his responsibilities at home. And the Philistine, namely Goliath, drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. Jesse said unto David, his son, now we're shifting back to Bethlehem at home. Jesse, the father, said to David, his son, take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves and run to the camp thy brethren. Now, parched corn is a grain that's been plucked just as it was ripening, and then it was roasted in a pan or in some iron plate. Arabs still eat parched corn. It's a very important part of their diet. And carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their 1,000, and look how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge. Take their pledge. In other words, really bring back home some evidence that you've completed your mission. That's really what's implied there. So now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose up early in the morning, left the sheep with the keeper, and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. He came to the trench as the host was going forth to fight, and shouted for the battle. The trench, or a place of carriage, is really what it is. And David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage and went into the army and came and saluted his brethren. As he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines, and spake according to the same words. And David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, and they were sore afraid. Understandable. And the men of Israel said, Have ye seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. In other words, that he will not only get great riches, he will get the king's daughter to wed, and he will be his house free, which means that the family would be free of any forced labor or any contributions to the crown. Now, he gets a tax-free status, so to speak. So that's the incentive. Obviously, Saul is hoping someone will rise to this occasion. And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, What shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? As they say in the Marine Corps sometimes, there's always a few percent that don't get the word, you know. No, David's attitude is, come on, guys, what's going on here? And the people answered him after this manner, saying, So shall it be done to the man that killeth him. In other words, they relate to David all what the prize will be if you kill him. And Eliab, his eldest brother, this is the firstborn of Jesse's sons, heard when he spake unto the man, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thine heart, for thou art come down that thou mightest see the battle. So his brothers are picking on him. Do you sense a parallel, by the way? Do you remember a guy by the name of Joseph, whose brothers resented him and were envious and so forth? There's a very, very similar parallel here. And of course, Satan always surfaces people that will say it can't be done. I assume you've run into some of those. Now, I might mention that Eliab was probably unaware that Samuel had anointed David to ultimately be king. In fact, that whole procedure may have been interpreted by his brothers as simply Samuel anointing David for service with Samuel. They may not have realized the implications of that event that occurred earlier. David said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? And he turned from him toward another and spake after the same manner. And the people answered him again after the former manner. When the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, here's David, this young kid is now up before the king. David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. This kid's going to, don't let anybody get panicked, I'll go. You know, you can only imagine Saul's reaction, you know. Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. David said to Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him, and smote him, and delivered out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and smote him, and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. You know, it's interesting to see David's perspective. You know, David, he's fearless. In fact, I'll show you in a few minutes how fearless he really was. He was far more fearless than most people have any idea. And he was quite knowledgeable, as you'll find out shortly. By the way, the Syrian bear was regarded as especially ferocious and appears to be more dreaded than the lion was. But in any case, that was in David's history, who he recounts it for the king. God tested David privately earlier with the lion and the bear. And now he's going to test him openly before the armies of Israel with this giant. And, you know, if we're faithful in our small private battles, they often are preludes to being publicly tested. Too often, God's people faint at the earlier tests and never get a chance at the big battles that are to come. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion. Notice who gets the credit. David's not retaking credit personally. Moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, go, and the Lord be with thee. And Saul armed David with his armor. Now, that's a very strange thing. Because Saul was a tall guy. Remember, he stood head and shoulders above all the rest in Israel at one time, apparently. David would have to be about his size to use his armor, or at least come close. So David, you always picture him as a small youth. He might have been, who knows, 20, I don't know. Saul armed David with his armor, and he put a helmet of brass on his head, and also he armed him with a coat of mail. David girded his sword upon his armor, and he essayed it to go, but for he had not proved it. David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not proved them. And David put them off him. How interesting it is. You know, it may sound good, but he hadn't been trained. He hadn't been practiced with that. So he took what he was familiar with. He took a staff in his hand, and he chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook and put them in a shepherd's bag, which he had, even in a script, and his sling was in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. A little background here. I personally suspect that David was taught how to use a sling by the Benjamites. The tribe of Benjamin is right adjacent to that part of that tribe of Judah. And it's very likely that David watched them practice. And if you may recall from our study in Judges 20, the Benjamites were famous for being able to hit a guy within a hairbreadth with their sling. They were expert sling. That featured very importantly in a number of the discussions we had in the book of Judges. And it's my suspicion that David, he certainly was very skilled with it, and he may have gotten that skill from the Benjamites. But there's another thing here that it always fascinates me, that most people who know this story don't pay attention to verse 40. How many stones did David pick out as he crossed the brook? He took five. How many did he need, ultimately, for Goliath? One. If he missed with the first one, he was over. He had to make that first one count. Well, what do you have the other four for? When you get to 2 Samuel, you'll discover that Goliath had four brothers. He was ready for all five. That, you know, that gives you a glimpse into this kid. Goliath was just the first. 2 Samuel 21, you'll discover the Goliath's four brothers get nailed by David's mighty men. We'll discover Ishbananab, Saph, and Lami. And there's one other we don't know the name of. In fact, Lami is there recorded as the brother of Goliath. But in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, his name is given. And so the point is that the giant, the father, had five of these offspring. And what we know about them is that they were sons of what they're called sons of Anak. Anak was one of the giants. Remember, Og up in the Bashan was the king of the giants. You find this word giant translated all through the Old Testament. The word is often the translation for the Nephilim or the Rephaim, but they're translated giants. They happen to be giants, but that's not perhaps the most distinguishing feature, because they also had six fingers and six toes. These were strange creatures. And they're called the Rephaim, and they're also called the Nephilim. And to really understand this, you got to get into Genesis chapter 6 and understand who the Nephilim really were, and understand that they weren't restricted to just before the flood. The flood was sent to wipe them out, because Satan's approach was to corrupt the genealogy of humankind. That's what the flood was sent. The shenanigans that brought those about occurred also after that, Genesis 6 verse 4 tells us. And you'll find all through the Old Testament, the giants mentioned, Og, the king of the giants. And sometimes they're called the Rephaim. That word is sometimes translated giant. It's sometimes translated dead, the walking dead. They were known to the Moabites as the Emim, these tribes, and to the Ammonites as the Zamzumim, in Deuteronomy 2. If you're sensitive to this and do your homework, you'll discover they pervade the Old Testament. It's very important to understand that these were strange creatures. They weren't just large and oversized. The words that are used here are translated giants and dead and so forth. There's a strange passage in Isaiah 26, which implies they're not eligible for resurrection. Christ never became a Nephilim and died for them. Different breed. Spooky stuff. Don't want to get into it all here. We take the classic, what's called the angel view of Genesis 6, which the ancient rabbis held and what the early church held up until the 5th century. It's tragically not taught in seminaries anymore, but it's the one that unquestionably we feel is portrayed in Scripture. And it's very relevant to your understanding of the Old Testament as well as some very important prophetic passages. So I'll leave that as a project for you to go on. But meanwhile, the Philistine came on and drew near to David, and the man that bare the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy of fair countenance. The Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that thou comest to me with staves?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give thee I'll give thy flesh to the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field." And they said David to the Philistines, "Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied. This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I'll smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." Boy, this is he's quite a kid. "And all this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with the sword and spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." And it came to pass when the Philistine arose, and he came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Now, it's very interesting. There are some scholars that have a conjecture regarding the Nephilim, that they may have had an eyesight problem. There's hints of that. And it could be that by running directly at him, that may have been an advantage in addition, just being obvious of being aggressive. That's a conjecture among some. I wouldn't sell it hard, but it's a possibility. In any case, David ran right to him, hasted to him. He put his hand in his bag and took a stone and slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead. This kid didn't miss. He was, you know, he was trained in that regard. And he fell upon his face to the earth. That's Goliath. And so David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and he smote the Philistine and slew him, but there was no sword in the hand of David. So what's he going to use? He'll use Goliath's. Therefore David ran and stood upon the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of the sheath thereof and slew him and cut off his head therewith. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. Gustave Doré, who was an artist, resident artist in the middle 19th century, has a lot of illustrations. Obviously, this is much portrayed in art. I just have thrown this in here because it's one person's view of the occasion. And the men of Israel and of Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until thou come to the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way to Sherem and even unto Gath and unto Ekron. And the children of Israel returned from chasing after the Philistines, and they spoiled their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought to Jerusalem, and he put his armor in his tent. And when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistines, he said to Abner, the captain of the host, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As thy soul liveth, O king, I cannot tell." The king said, "Inquire thou whose son this stripling is." This is a passage that caused a lot of confusion. A lot of people wondered, gee, how could Saul not recognize the kid? That may not be the issue here. First of all, David's previous commerce with Saul was intermittent, and not alone. There are lots of others that were probably in that, sort of that category. But that's not the point. The real point is here, he may know who David was. He didn't know, he wants to know. This kid's now going to be subject, he's going to be a son-in-law. He wants to understand his background, his connection, his family. So he's really asking not who is the kid, whose son is he? Inquire whose son the stripling is. And David returned from the slaughter of the Philistines. Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. "Hey, look what I got." Saul said to him, "Whose son art thou, thou young man?" David answered, "I am the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." And that's the end of that chapter 17. Now, the subsequent chapters are going to deal with David's activities in the court of Saul. But by the way, not to build a big case out of this, but you might reflect on some of this. David is, in a sense, a picture of Jesus Christ. David's name means beloved, and of course Christ was God's beloved son. Both were born in Bethlehem. Both were rejected by their brethren. And of course, when David became king, his brethren received him, just like Joseph's brothers ultimately discovered him. And after the initial rejection, the Jews will discover Christ. And that parallel is very real. So David was anointed king long before he reigned. And of course, Christ is king now, but he will not reign on the earth until Satan is dealt with. Now, King Saul, in a sense, can be viewed as a type of Satan in this age. Rejected and defeated, yet permitted to reign until David's ready for the throne. And Satan's permitted to persecute God's people, and yet one day he too will be dealt with. Just as David was sent by his father to the battlefield, so Christ was sent by his father to this world. And Goliath can be seen as representing Satan's pride and power. You can read Luke 11:14-23, and as you put that in your notes to check into, you know, Satan's the strong man guarding his goods, that is the people under his control. Christ is a stronger one that overcomes him in that parable, and so on. So Christ invaded Satan's kingdom. He's going to take his armor and now dividing his spoils by saving lost souls and making them children of God. And that's what, in a sense, David did that day. Just like Christ, David had his victory. We don't fight for victory, we fight from victory. The victory was at the cross. "Be of good cheer," Jesus said. "I have overcome the world." Okay, we're in chapter 18, David and Saul's court. "It came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." I remember I was taking one of my early tours to Israel, and we had a wonderful tour, but near the end we had a campfire by the sea, and we were all just sharing what things meant for you. Everybody was sharing what the trip had meant to them. Well, I had discovered on this trip there was a guy that had signed on with the trip that turned out to be a very well-known Bible teacher. And we just had a wonderful friendship. And near the end, I said, "Well, what was your purpose?" He said, "Oh, I just attending to my knitting." And he used this verse. because our souls were knit together. That was what he was saying. I'll never forget. I always remember that when I see this. And it was, it's the same word, by the way, in the Hebrew. In Genesis 44:30, expressed Jacob's love for Benjamin. Remember Jacob's, you know, the youngest son, Benjamin. Same term is used. But Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Now, Jonathan had every reason to resent David because David hadn't come along. The dynasty was his. He would have been the next king. But he's not jealous. He loves David, and he really helps him. You're going to see they become bonded. They're real soulmates. And Saul took him that day and would let him go no more home to his father's house. That is David. And Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David and his garments, even his sword, and to his bow and to his girdle. He stripped himself of his own royal regalia and gave it to David. This is in effect probably in recognition of David's divine election to be king. There's other examples of this kind of thing in classical literature, but I'll just keep moving on. David went out whithersoever Saul sent him and behaved himself wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war. He was even on top of Saul's personal bodyguard, at least at this point. And he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So David was popular. Everybody liked him. It came to pass, as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tabrets and with joy and with instruments of music. The women answered one another as they played and said, "Saul hath slain his thousands and David his 10,000s." That didn't sit too well with Saul, of course. That didn't sit well with him at all. Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. And what can he have more but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day on. So now David's in trouble. Proverbs 27:21, "As the fining pot for silver and the furnace for gold, so is a man to his praise." It's dangerous to start believing your own press releases. See, the praise that made David humble brought the dross in Saul's heart to the top and revealed his pride and his desire for glory. It came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul. That's permissive spirit. In other words, he could have done it without God's permission, of course. And he prophesied in the midst of the house. And David played with his hand as at other times, and there was a javelin in Saul's hand. Now, this is very strange. It seems that Saul seems to have a javelin in his hand a lot. He may have had it like a scepter, and that was an ancient custom that some kings did that. They had a javelin like you and I think of a scepter. And Saul cast the javelin, for he said, "I will smite David even to the wall with it." And David avoided out of his presence twice. This happened twice, not just once. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him and he was departed from Saul. So Saul, rather than recognizing the situation in his reality, it struck him with terror. Therefore Saul moved him from him and made him captain over 1,000. In other words, he demoted him. And he went out and came out and in before the people. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways. And the Lord was with him. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. And all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. He's a man of the people, in other words. And Saul said to David, "Behold, my elder daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul said, "Let not mine hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him." In other words, Saul's hoping that being in combat, that David would get nailed. David said to Saul, "Who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be a son-in-law of the king?" So there's David's humility is right out there in front. "But it came to pass at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, to wife." So Saul didn't keep his promise. This gal was given to another. And Michal, Saul's daughter, that's another daughter he had, loved David. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him, because he sees this, you see, as an opportunity. And Saul said, "I will give him her, that she may be a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Wherefore Saul said to David, "Thou shalt this day be my son-in-law, in one of the two daughters. And Saul commanded his servants, saying, commune with David secretly, and say, behold, the king hath delight in thee, and all his servants love thee. Now therefore be the king's son-in-law. And Saul's servants spake these words in the ears of David, and David said, seemeth it to you a light thing to be a king's son-in-law, seeing that I'm a poor man and lightly esteemed? The servants of Saul told him, saying, on this manner spake David. And Saul said, thus shall you say to David, the king desireth not any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to be avenged of the king's enemies. Interesting trophy to bring home, huh? But Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of Philistines. You know, knock off 100 of these guys, you know, and that's your price instead of a usual dowry. When his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. The days had not been fulfilled yet. Wherefore David arose and went, he and his men, and slew the Philistines 200 men. He got twice as many. And David brought their foreskins and gave them all in full tally to the king, that he might be the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, to wife. I'm sure Saul was very disappointed that David was so successful. You know, I don't know how you would dramatize this on a TV special or a movie, you know. Bring in those bags, guys. You know, what do you do? Spill them on the floor and count them? I don't know. You know, King James can be very graphic. There's a number of my favorite passages that are more explicit than King James than any of the so-called modern euphemisms around. But enough of that. And Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. And Saul was yet the more afraid of David. Saul became David's enemy continually, and the princes of the Philistines went forth. And it came to pass that after they went forth, that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was much set by. So go to Samuel 19. Then Saul spake to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. Get the picture here. David has been anointed to be king, but the king is plotting to kill him. And the king has resources. Visible and invisible resources. And David's in trouble. But he's got an ally. Jonathan, the king's son. Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, seeketh to kill thee. Now therefore I pray thee, take heed to thyself until the morning, and abide in a secret place and hide thyself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art. And I will commune with my father of thee. And what I see, that will I tell thee. Jonathan spake good of David unto Saul his father, and said unto him, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he hath not sinned against thee, and because his works have been to thee word very good. For he had put his life in his hand, and slew the Philistine. And the Lord brought a great salvation for all Israel. Thou sawest it, and thou didst rejoice. Wherefore then wilt thou sin against innocent blood, to slay David without a cause? And Saul hearkened to the voice of Jonathan. And Saul swear, as the Lord liveth, he shall not be slain. Is Saul being hypocritical here? Or is he a manic depressive? Is he subject to mood swings? Don't know. That's not clear. But you know, he swears before God that he'll not kill David. Jonathan called David, and Jonathan showed him all these things, and Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past. Looks like everything's honky-dory, huh? And there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and slew them with a great slaughter, and they fled from him. And the evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul as he sat in his house with his javelin in his hand. And David's there playing with his harp. And Saul sought to smite David even to the wall with the javelin, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence, and he smote the javelin to the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. So there's apparently a third time that he escaped in the nick of time. Saul also sent messengers unto David's house to watch him and to slay him in the morning. He's in trouble. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, if I save not thy life tonight, tomorrow thou shalt be slain. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went and fled and escaped. Now, it's also very reminiscent, this whole episode, very reminiscent of, remember Rahab at Jericho, and also you may remember Saul, who was called Paul later, was led out of Damascus the same way. It's possible that her window was strategically placed on a wall or something. Anyway, he slipped out and escaped. Michal then takes an image, an idol, by the way, a teraphim, and laid it in the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster and covered it with a cloth. You know, it's interesting. She's helping him right now, but their marriage is not a happy one, because later on, when David's in exile, the next few chapters, Michael is going to be given by Saul to another man. That's in chapter 25. But David will get her back when he starts reigning as king at Hebron. Her attitude toward David, though, leads to a total separation later. So it was not a happy relationship, downstream. But now there's another interesting aspect to this ruse here. By the way, the reason she has an idol, which is a no-no, according to Mosaic Judaism. But she was barren, and that may be one of the reasons that she has a teraphim in a secret because of her barrenness. Now, Josephus relates that Michael placed a still-moving goat liver in the bed to make the messengers believe that there was breathing, because it can still, apparently, it can still throb for a while. And that's Josephus recounts that, just to add a little color to thing. Can you imagine? So if you're ever going to, sneak out at night and put something in your bed, you might consider just putting goat's liver in there. So, okay. I've never tried it, but, Josephus, I don't know. Yeah, okay. So anyway, the idea is to make it look like David's sick in bed is the whole point. And so when Saul sent his message to take David, she said, he is sick. Saul sent the message again to see David, saying, bring him to me in the bed that I may slay him. Saul's upset. And when the messengers were come in, behold, there was an image in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster. And Saul said to Michael, why hast thou deceived me so and sent away mine enemy that he has escaped? Michael answered and said, he said unto me, let me go. Why should I kill thee? In other words, she tries to make it look like David threatened her life. That's why she did this. So David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Samuel had done in him. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naioth. Now, the word Naioth refers to some special dwellings. That Ramah was Samuel's hometown. And this is also where there are allusions here, like it's a school, that this is where Samuel had a school for the prophets. We don't know a lot about it. It's only alluded to from time to time. It was told Saul, saying, behold, David is at Naioth at Ramah. So there's apparently a collection of buildings there, this school thing that Samuel was in charge of. And Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as anointed over them, the Spirit of God was upon the messenger of Saul. So they also prophesied. And what's implied by the prophesy here, they're in a trance. They're in an ecstatic trance of some kind. They were, and so the messengers also get in this mode. And when it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. And Saul sent the messengers again a third time, and they prophesied also. When he also went to Ramah and came to a great well that is in Seku, and asked and said, where are Samuel and David? And one said, behold, they be at Naioth at Ramah. And he went thither to Naioth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God was upon him also. In other words, upon Saul. And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naioth and Ramah. And he stripped off his clothes also and prophesied before Samuel in like manner. Lay down naked all that day and all that night. Wherefore they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Because he also got involved in this ecstatic thing. So now this starts really David fleeing into exile. David fled from Naioth and Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, what have I done? What is mine iniquity? What is my sin before thy father? He seeketh my life. He said unto him, God forbid thou shalt not die. Behold, my father will do nothing, either great or small, but he will show it to me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. Jonathan can't really believe that Saul is really doing all this. David sware moreover and said, thy father certainly knoweth that I have found grace in thine eyes. And he saith, let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly as the Lord liveth, as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death. And the Hebrew commentators say about that step is really referring to the fact that he took a step to duck the javelin. That's really what's implied by the language here. And then said Jonathan to David, whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will even do it for thee. David said to Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat. But let me go that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. See, at the new moon, every month, the new moon was marked the month, and there was always a feast each time. And the feast was ceremonially prescribed. You'll find it in 2 Kings 4, Isaiah 1, 13, Amos 8, 5. It's one of the main festivals. It's not just a religious festival. It's also, as Numbers 10 and 28 would detail, it's also a civil festival. And since David was a member of the royal household, in effect, he was expected to be there at the noon new moon sacrificial meal. So if thy father at all miss me, say, David earnestly asked me to leave that he might run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. And if he say this, it is well, thy servant shall have peace. But if he be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined by him. This is sort of a sign that David's seeking. Therefore thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of the Lord with thee. Notwithstanding, if there be in me iniquity, slay me thyself. For why shouldest thou bring me to thy father? Jonathan said, far be it from thee. For if I knew certainly that evil were determined by my father to come upon thee, then would I not tell thee? Then said David to Jonathan, who shall tell me? And what if thy father answer thee roughly? Jonathan said unto David, come and let us go out in the field. And they went out, both of them, into the field. And they set up a code here, in effect. Jonathan said unto David, O Lord God of Israel, when I have sounded my father out tomorrow at any time, or on the third day, behold, if there be good toward David, then I shall send not for thee and show it thee. The Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it please my father do thee evil, then I will show it thee and send thee away, that thou mayest go in peace. And the Lord be with thee as he hath been with my father. Thou shalt not only while yet I live show me kindness of the Lord, that I die not. What he's talking about here is that when David gets to be king, he's asking that he and his progeny get protected by the king for this commitment. But also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever, no, not when the Lord hath cut off the enemies of David, every one of them, from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Lord even require it at the hand of David's enemies. And Jonathan caused David to swear again because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. And then Jonathan said to David, tomorrow is the new moon, and thou shalt be missed because thy seat will be empty. And when thou hast stayed 3 days, then thou shalt go down quickly and come to the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand, and thou shalt remain by the stone Ezel. And I will shoot 3 arrows on the side thereof, as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send a lad, saying, go find out the arrows. And if I expressly say to the lad, behold, the arrows are on this side of thee, take them and come thou, for there is peace to thee and no hurt, as the Lord liveth. But if I say thus to the young man, behold, the arrows are beyond thee, go thy way, for the Lord hath sent thee away. So that's the code that they've set up, in effect. As touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, the Lord be between thee and me forever. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon was come, the king sat him down to eat meat, and the king sat upon his seat, as at other times, even upon the seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner by Saul's side, and David's place was empty. Abner is the king of the head of the army, and so that it was obvious because of the protocol, the seating, that David's seat was conspicuous and that it was empty. Nevertheless, Saul spake not anything that day, for he thought something hath befallen him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. In other words, he would have to be ceremonially clean in order to participate in this dinner. But see, that uncleanness would expire at sunset. So even if that was an excuse for the first day, it wouldn't pertain to the second and third day, see. It came to pass on the morrow, which was the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said unto Jonathan's son, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meet, neither yesterday nor today? And Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go, I pray thee, for our family hath a sacrifice in the city, and my brother, he hath commanded me to be there. And now if I have found favor in thine eyes, let me get away, I pray thee, and see my brethren. Therefore he cometh not unto the king's table. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. See, Jonathan's risking his own life here, in effect, with these stories. His anger was kindled against Jonathan. He said unto him, thou son of perverse, rebellious woman, do not I know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness? He's even accusing Jonathan of having a doubtful heritage here. For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Now he's pointing out to Jonathan that Jonathan's loyalty for David is undermining the dynasty, Saul's and Jonathan's and so on. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die. Jonathan answered Saul his father and said unto him, wherefore shall he be slain? What hath he done? And Saul cast a javelin at him to smite him, whereby Jonathan knew that it was determined of his father to slay David. Man, Saul has thrown a lot of javelins. So Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and did eat no meat the second day of the month. He was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. It came to pass in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David with a little lad with him. And he said to his lad, "Run, find out now the arrows which I shoot." As the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the lad was come to the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond thee?" That's the code, see? Jonathan cried after the lad, "Make speed, haste, stay not." He's not talking to the lad, he's talking to David, who's hiding there. Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the lad knew not anything, only Jonathan and David knew the matter. And Jonathan gave his artillery unto his lad and said unto him, "Go, carry them to the city." And as soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of the place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground and bowed himself three times. They kissed, because he's honoring Jonathan, because he's still the son of the king, so he's the prince. They kissed one another and wept one another until David acceded. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever.'" And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So we're seeing the sunset on Saul. He had early promise, as we noticed. He was strikingly had physical superiority. Originally, Saul was modest, direct, and generous, but his pride gets away from him. He starts with the irreverent presumption, willful impatience, you remember that? Finally, disobedience and deceit over Agag with Samuel and all that. He didn't destroy the Amalekites. That's a key thing. And he's going to have his climax in the session after next with the witch at Endor. Very spooky story. In our next session, we're going to explore a series of chapters that with David fleeing as a fugitive, David in exile. And a number of interesting episodes occur in that session. And following all of that in the final session, which will be the session after next, Samuel will have died by then. Saul is in panic because Samuel was his only friend. And he resorts to consorting with a medium. That's a strange story because Samuel shows up at that seance. And boy, does that raise some questions that we'll be talking about when we get there. Very appropriate for our Halloween season. And that will conclude Samuel, the book of 1 Samuel, which is primarily focusing on the career of Saul. And 2 Samuel will deal with the rise of David as a king. Let's stand for a closing word of prayer. Well, Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the example of David, how we thrill at his courage and conviction and his confidence, not in his own skills, but in the God of Israel. What an example he gives all of us, because we all encounter our giants, those things that we think we can't overcome. And yet, Father, help us to understand that you have overcome the world. We thank you, Father, for David's example. We thank you for your word. We also thank you for the lessons of his failures, that we might learn from them too, as we commit ourselves, Father, into your hands, in the name of Yeshua, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.